You're listening to the Arsenal for Democracy, forging and preparing a new generation for leadership. Now, here's your host, Bill Humphrey.
For 91.3 FM WVUD and WVUD HD1 Newark in the great state of Delaware, I'm Bill Humphrey, and thanks for listening. I'm coming to you on June 1st, 2015, from my studio in Newton, Massachusetts. This week, Nate joins me to discuss emerging themes of the Democratic primary and the raid on FIFA. Then, guest Blue Hen Kevin joins me to remember Beau Biden. All that is coming up right now on Arsenal for Democracy. Arsenal for Democracy is usually recorded in studio every Monday and is available for download on Wednesdays at arsenalfordemocracy.com and from iTunes. We air the show in Delaware on 91.3 FM and stream it from WVUD.org on Wednesdays at 6 p.m. Eastern. Follow us on Twitter at AFD Radio or like us on Facebook. This is the Arsenal for Democracy. It's Arsenal for Democracy. I'm your host, Bill Humphrey. Joining me in studio, as usual, is Nate. Nate, welcome back.
Thanks a lot, Bill.
So we're going to talk first about the Democratic primary, just kind of updating folks on that, but also just sort of looking at some emerging larger thematic points that are coming out here. Because as usual, as I always say, I'm not that interested in the, you know, horse race aspect of who did what this time and who did this and who, you know, who's ahead this week or whatever. That I don't care that much about. I care more about some of the like bigger picture stuff, the issues, the themes, how it's influencing the party, that sort of thing. So the first thing I wanted to look at was an article that was published on the website of the Columbia Journalism Review about coverage of Bernie Sanders. Sort of the central point that the author was making there was that there's two problems with the coverage that we've seen. This is an article by Steve Hendricks. First is lack of coverage by many outlets relative to other candidates. And second is the type of coverage. And I think that sort of abstractly, I wouldn't be necessarily that surprised or, you know, particularly offended, but, you know, because we've seen this kind of thing with sort of, you know, so-called marginal candidates on the Democratic side before. The problem this year that has really highlighted this, and I think is worth definitely discussing, is that he's getting so much less coverage and less favorable or at least neutral coverage in major media outlets than the Republicans, particularly the non-mainstream Republicans. And I think that we sort of, you know, this in 2012, it was masked by the fact that Obama was running unopposed on the Democratic side. So, of course, somebody like a Herman Cain gets more attention or whatever than, you know, maybe normally. But
I forgot about Herman Cain for a second there.
Right. I would have forgotten if not for Jon Stewart mentioning him in explicitly in contrast with somebody like Bernie Sanders. But like there are also fairly, you know, kind of fringe extreme candidates on the Republican side this time as well. But they're still getting far more coverage than a Bernie Sanders. And as this article goes into great detail, both with various, you know, current stats and historical examples, it's just not justified, the relative disparity in volume of coverage as well as the sort of tone of the coverage. So, Nate, what were some themes that jumped out at you from this article?
Yeah, well, one thing that Hendricks, I think, does a good job of is showing that when you're sort of talking about these early primary races, you don't always know how things are going to unfold. You know, he just looks at the example of, you know, even Jimmy Carter. They apparently at one point they ran a survey about, you know, who in this Democratic primary are you interested? Do you think has the potential? There were 35 potential candidates and he wasn't on the list. So, you know, eventually he was able to just build up, just get some support and eventually won the Democratic primary. I don't remember all the necessary details of that election, but if I'm trying to remember correctly, I think the not necessarily conservative, but more evangelical Democrats, religious, he had obviously had a good deal of pull with them. So, you know, eventually you can be able to build up a campaign. But, you know, he also points to the examples of Michael Dukakis. There were some fortunate things that happened in the Democratic primary for him that year, but he was only polling at 1% before he announced. You know, right now Sanders is polling anywhere from 5 to 8%. So
yeah, there was actually a poll by Quinnipiac, which put it at, I believe, 15% in a, I think, a five-way or something like that. Yeah, it was in a poll that was of Democratic voters nationwide, had Clinton, Sanders, Biden, and I think O'Malley, and whoever else is, you know, the really minor people. Sanders had gotten up to 15% as of May, late May, and that was up significantly from previously. So, like, this is way above that level that we're talking about.
Yeah, and even Obama, okay, he was only polling at 24 to 22% apparently around this time last, or in the last election cycle, or Democratic primary cycle. But Hillary at that point was around 40, 45. So I think the main thing we should take away from this is it's still very early and these things can change dramatically. But I think it is important to note the difference sort of between his or between the political views that are deemed acceptable by the media in some way. So as you say, it doesn't seem like there's a lack of attention that we can ever give to the Republicans, even when their positions are so wide, like outside of the mainstream or just set to such an extreme level because they're pandering to their base or whatever. Those people get tremendous amounts of media attention and generally are taken more or less seriously. But I guess the thing that we're trying to look at here is, are candidates like Bernie Sanders, who may be more, you know, equivalent on the left compared to some of these guys are on the right, maybe even less so, you know, maybe just sort of written off, and whether it's the corporate media, whether it's just people in general, that maybe they don't think he has a real shot, so they're just not going to talk about him. But I think that does maybe a potential disservice to the level of support that he has, the money he's raising. He is raising, I believe he had a first day, $1.5 million.
Yeah.
The Washington Post says they may be able to raise $50 million to run a, like, quote-unquote credible campaign, like a real campaign with offices and, you know, get out the vote efforts and everything. So I don't think he's actually that far away from being a contending candidate, a credible candidate who's at least going to go, I don't know if he's going to go the distance. I don't know what level of support he's going to get in any one specific primary, but I think he's going to be in there fighting, you know? I think he's going to be part of the debates. He's going to be attacking other candidates on issues where maybe he's to the left of them and try to draw some daylight between himself and the other candidates. I don't think he's someone that we should be ignoring necessarily, considering that he does have a sort of unique perspective and will take positions that are not in the Democratic mainstream because, you know, he has declared himself the socialist mayor of Burlington at one point. So he wants Scandinavian style social democracy, or at least parts of it, to be implemented here. So there are a lot of ideas that he can bring to this race, and I think it's important that we sort of just not write him off because, oh, he's a leftist. Okay, well, he's a leftist that has a lot of money and is a Democratic primary and is presenting potentially valuable ideas for the country. So we need to pay attention.
Yeah, I mean, he's already raised, I believe, $5 million. He apparently has more volunteers already signed up at this point than Obama did at a similar point in 2007. You know, he's certainly never going to like outraise Hillary Clinton or anything like that, but we are now starting to see that he's going to be able to put together a very, very credible operation to, at least as Nate put it, you know, be in there fighting and staying in that race for quite a long time. He's not going to just, you know, flame out immediately in all likelihood. It's also, you know, he's not going to be pulling, you know, 2% in the actual primaries and caucuses. Maybe he's not, you know, he might, maybe we don't know yet at this point if he's going to win some of them or any of them. Honestly, I wouldn't put it past him to win at least a few states in this. I think that's at least a distinct possibility. But to your point, you know, some of this, like the outcome is determined by the volume and type of coverage. So, you know, like somebody like Ted Cruz has a very strong but extremely narrow base of support, right? The people who love him, but there aren't that many of them. And he is really off-putting to a lot of people. And more importantly, his policy views are just not supported by a majority of Americans. I mean, he's completely on like a different, you know, track at this point, supporting like a constitutional amendment to ban same-sex marriage, things like that. These are things that he's pushing now in 2015, not in, you know, 2004 or something like that, right? And he's getting, you know, maybe they're not necessarily glowing profiles, but many thousand word profiles in the New York Times or the Washington Post or whatever, telling his life story. I think there was a stat about the positioning of coverage in the newspapers.
Yeah, and the Sanders announcement in the New York Times was on page A21. And if anyone hasn't really, you know, opened up a New York Times paper copy, that's pretty much towards the back. It might even be on the back page. I'm not exactly sure of the news section. So definitely can be buried towards the back. And it was only about 700 words, just the comparison, I guess, to Rubio, Rand Paul, Ted Cruz, Hillary Clinton, all got upwards of 1,100 words to 1,500, so definitely more in-depth. There's a Washington Post personality piece. Obviously, you'll always run one of these. Oh, also, I should, I guess, note that the New York Times pieces were all above the fold on the front page for everyone else, pretty much.
Right. So when they announced, yeah, they got front page treatment, and Sanders, that's pushed all the way back to A21. Yeah. I mean, that's the kind of stuff that we're talking about here. The coverage now is going to help determine how things play out, right? So, like, they're providing all this coverage to somebody like Cruz or Rubio or whatever, and but, you know, while simultaneously saying they don't have to cover Sanders because he doesn't matter or whatever. It's like, okay, but at the same time, you know, you can disagree, and I think there's a lot of reasons to disagree with having Iowa and New Hampshire as the, you know, first places in the country, or then South Carolina right after that, right? There's been tons of criticism. I think a lot of it's merited. However, the reason ostensibly that we do it that way is because these are basically small campaign environments where you can really get to meet people interpersonally, that sort of thing, and you know, really work on actually getting your message out to people directly, not just relying on, you know, TV ad wars. And as long as we're going to have a system that's set up like this, favoring those type of states early on, we should be taking advantage of that fact and really, like, being like, okay, here are all the different candidates. And, you know, if you do a good, credible job in those states, like putting together an operation, you deserve to have coverage regardless, yeah, of what level you're polling
that's
at.
That's the meritocracy. But unfortunately, I think in this horse race coverage, you sort of go into it with preconceived notions about who deserves to be the nominee or who deserves to be a credible candidate. And the ruling class, the chattering class, people that write these newspaper articles and, you know, decide TV news coverage and things like that, they're not really on board with Bernie. I'm just gonna put an example here from the article we're talking about, and just it sort of contrasts his positions on some key issues like, oh, I don't know, Social Security, Keystone XL, Trans-Pacific Partnership, Too Big to Fail Bank, Social Security. He has taken dramatically different positions than Hillary Clinton, who, you know, whether through her actions or whether what she's said in general. So there are differences between them. And this is just one quote here. Hillary's corporatism led to her social liberalism and imperial hawkishness appeals to those in the moneyed second and journalistic fourth estates who would embrace republicanism, but for its misogynistic, homophobic, racist, science denying core. So, I mean, that's pretty much right at the bows. I mean, there are people in the media who like Hillary, who sort of agree with her generally. I mean, there are a lot of media people that are very, you know, in the middle politically, and what that means is they have certain Republican tendencies and they have certain Democratic tendencies, or liberal, conservative, whatever you want to say. And I think Hillary is sort of in that position. I mean, she's hawkish. She's not that liberal when it comes to economics, and especially compared to someone like Sanders.
Right.
So, you know, this sort of does fit into some of the niches that are very supported by, I'd say, the establishment elite. And at any, pretty much every moment, they're looking for ways to sort of go after Sanders. Okay, quote unquote, he can't win. Why is this crank running? You know, CBS News devoting, I think it was only a couple seconds for Sanders, as opposed to, you know, long pieces about Hillary and the Hillary campaign. Yeah, ABC World News Tonight gave his announcement all of 18 seconds, five of which were allotted to Clinton's tweet welcoming it into the race. And so then you have a two-minute report about Clinton later. So, the CBS Evening News fitted the announcement of Sanders' announcement into a single sentence into the Hillary report.
Right.
So they're not even giving him an announcement. They're just talking about Hillary. So, you know, I think it's pretty clear where the media support is in this presidential
right.
race.
And I just, you know, it's really bothering me that, you know, even setting aside Clinton, the gap between the like what these candidates are putting out versus what the American people want is much bigger on the Republican side in many cases than on the and then with Sanders, right? Sanders, you know, wants to expand and strengthen Social Security. He wants to, you know, make college affordable or even free in terms of a public college option at various states. That's one of his latest proposals. You know, a lot of things like he's not, you know, not only is he not promoting like a revolutionary socialism or anything, but he's kind of actually moderated a lot of his positions to be to fit, you know, squarely within what used to be, you know, 15, 20 years ago, completely mainstream Democratic Party views. And I would argue are still fairly mainstream within the base.
Well, I would say this is pretty interesting. The Hillary profile, this is contrasting them. The Hillary profile calls her a populist and then goes out of their way to, you know, portray Sanders as an ex-hippie septuagenarian socialist from the liberal reaches of Vermont who rails against the billionaire class taking over the... Oh, first of all, are there non-liberal reaches of Vermont? I mean, maybe...
Well, he also, in the area, the few areas that are conservative, he does pretty well with Republicans.
Vermont is, like, all farmland and, like, mountains and, like, Canada up north if you get close to it. So, there, I'm sure there are conservative parts. But, yeah, as you say, he's, you know, pretty broadly popular there. He's not, like... this radical, I think, that he's just being made out to be. And Hillary is the populist?
Somehow.
Somehow? Because I'm pretty sure Bernie Sanders has actually been espousing the populism, which was pretty eschewed by the, you know, sort of the mainstream of the Democratic Party, led by the Clintons during the third way. And Bernie Sanders has just been up there in Vermont this whole time, basically with the same sort of principles of positions. Maybe, as you say, he's tweaked them a little bit in recent years, but it's not like, you know, he's done an about face and is now somehow a different candidate or different person
right.
with different ideas.
I think the main thing is that he's narrowed down the sort of menu of what he's looking for. And also is presenting it much better than he used to.
Yeah,
in
and
the
that's
past,
what you need
right?
to do if you're trying to market exactly. yourself on the national stage and not just to, you know, plaid wearing cow farmers up there in Vermont. But I think he does have a certain, I don't know if warmth is the right word. He's, you know, definitely an older guy, but it doesn't.
He's very engaging.
Yeah, he's
you
not
know, especially in these smaller.
He doesn't
events.
Seem fake. He's not like a plastic politician. Just like wrap him out of the box, and you know he's going to shake everyone's hand, kiss all the babies, and so.
And he's been out there in these states actually talking to people. And, you know, the media has been lately very obsessed with the fact that Hillary Clinton isn't talking to them very much and isn't doing interviews. And it's like, guys, the story here is not that Hillary Clinton isn't talking to you. The story is that she's not talking to voters either. Like, she has completely gone into this totally walled-in environment. You know, she's doing, you know, closed-door, no invite, you know, or rather invite-only, no public allowed fundraisers in places like Atlanta or wherever, right? There are Democrats in these states, and the Clinton campaign will literally say to the media, we don't consider this to be a blue state or, like, a competitive state. And it's like, yeah, that's not the point. There are still Democrats in these places who can, you know, help you in some way, whether it's going down to Florida to campaign or giving you their money or supporting you during, you know, the primary, that kind of thing. Or you could actually work on making some of these states competitive, because that was something that helped in the 2008 primary. You know, it was very contested. You actually put states like North Carolina and Indiana into play by having a competitive race there. But she's not talking to voters, you know, in these open forums, right? Somebody like, you know, a Bernie Sanders, if someone, you know, in Iowa says, oh, I heard you were a crazy radical socialist, you know, and starts, you know, trying to get in his face or whatever, he'll just engage that person and have a conversation about it. I think this is part of this wider just problem that there's this shift toward these manufactured campaigns, as Nate said, you know, these pop them out of the box and put them on the trail. And a lot of that relates to these sort of consultants and staff that want to remain, you know, they need to be in control. They need the power. They don't get that if the candidate's actually out there talking to people and having real interactions. This is another thing that, you know, had come up at Columbia, and Jay Rosen in particular wrote a whole thing about sort of the media's weird coverage of the non-media coverage or interviews that, you know, that Hillary was or wasn't doing. And he's saying, look, like, you know, there's this whole drift toward these sort of TV ad based campaigns and away from actual interactions with voters and things like that. Why aren't you covering that instead of like, you know, in any other field, you know, non-political coverage, right? It would be super stupid for a journalist to say, well, I can't do my job because the person won't talk to me. It's like, oh, the CEO of the company won't talk to you. Then you go find another way of getting that information, right? You don't write a piece about complaining that you couldn't get access, because they've just gotten so obsessed with the access. And, you know, one of the other stories that's come out, this is a New York Times headline, Democrats seek a richer roster to match GOP, right? This is totally being driven by the people on the Clinton side as opposed to the people more on the Sanders side, which is that instead of going in the Obama direction, and obviously Obama had his own issues with the big money fundraisers and stuff like that, especially in 2012, but, you know, go in the 2008 Obama direction where it's all about grassroots mobilization, growing the party in new places, getting people who wouldn't normally vote, you know, engaged and active in voting, right? Instead, they're saying, oh, the Republicans have all these mega donors. Well, we need mega donors too. And this is something we talked about on the show several weeks ago. I think you and Sasha were here for that, which is like, you're never going to outraise the Republicans. You're never going to get that gigantic amount of money from these few people, right? The only way that Democrats are going to make this work is by running campaigns that have broad inherent mass appeal and get people to actually help and donate their small dollar donations that add up and things like that, right? That's a much bigger, stronger base. And you're not doing that because instead you're saying, well, oh, can we get this, you know, donor, or can we get that donor? And, you know, but well, maybe we can get them to be secret donors and stuff. And in addition to the super PACs, and it's like, all of this is not helping the party. It's just making the party more and more dependent on, you know, doing these big ad buys and things like that that aren't really going to have much effect, or paying consultants in huge amounts that's not going to have that much effect. Somebody like a Sanders, yeah, I don't know at this point if he can win, but what I do know is that he has A, enough money to be credible, and B, maybe he can actually use that money on things that, you know, matter, like field operations and stuff like that. And that's been kind of this Democratic tendency to be like, no, let's just like try to coerce a bunch of college students into volunteering for us or whatever, instead of, you know, actually, you know, doing the level of work and investment in your ground campaign and inspiring people to volunteer their time rather than just demanding it. You know, well, you're Democrats, so you're supposed to get out there and volunteer. You know, do you want the Republicans to win? It's like, well, you know, the easier way would just be to run on stuff that makes people actually want to show up instead of trying to guilt trip them into doing it. But, you know, whatever. Nate, did you have any closing thoughts on this topic before we go to the break?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's just the very early stages of the campaign here, and we're sort of just seeing how things will begin to shape up or sort of shape out over the course of the long campaign. I think it could be potentially be an issue if the entire campaign sort of just gets subsumed with Hillary talk or Hillary watching, and, you know, and we sort of stop paying attention to these other candidates who, okay, yes, they're not as quote-unquote electable and quote-unquote, I don't know, have broad base of support historically, but these are, I mean, some of these guys are people that should have their ideas seriously examined, see if they could have an impact, see if they might be useful for a job in administration if they don't win, if the Democrats somehow win. So we can't just allow ourselves to be subsumed by just, okay, what position is Hillary taking today? What is she doing, or who is she meeting with? And if that's all the campaign coverage is about, then, I mean, I'm probably not even going to watch too much of it, to be honest. So we really need to hopefully get a good discussion of the various viewpoints in the Democratic primary, because I would say this is a pretty important almost juncture for the Democratic Party. After, you know, say 8 years of Obama, we'll have, you know, been in power for a while. Some of our ideas will have gotten across and been implemented, but certainly not nearly as many as I think most of us were initially hoping for. Like, not to place all of the blame on that on Obama, but it just, you know, when you think about how the priority of immigration reform, how that was at the very beginning, and how that's, you know,
just been kicked down. Yeah,
there's nothing there. So there's a lot of issues that are very important going forward, and I think this primary process needs to be a place where we hash these issues out and not just get caught horse race watching and just ignore the whole thing.
I think also, you know, just as a very final thought here, like you said, these ideas deserve to be heard because this is supposed to be a representative democracy. So on some level, it's supposed to be the people, not the media or the politicians, deciding what you know, we want our government to be doing, right? If there's a really bad, quote unquote, populist idea, that's not the job of the media to decide, okay, we're not going to cover it and then it'll go away or whatever. That's the job of the other politicians to go out there and basically campaign against it and show people why it's a bad idea. It's not your, if you think that something is a bad policy or not a policy that's supported by people, that's not your job in the media to say, well, I'm not going to cover this because it's stupid, right? I mean, if it's an obviously, you know, false, scientifically ungrounded thing, I think maybe there's a case to be made for it. But for more economic things, it's generally very hard to prove that in any sort of empirical way, whether it's quote unquote good or bad. It's usually it takes a while to figure that out, and it's competing political theories essentially. You know, that's what it is at the base of it. So we need to be able to actually have people weigh in on these ideas and hear some of these ideas. And if they're bad and people don't want them, then let the people decide that. We're going to be right back in just a moment from WVUD and ArsenalForDemocracy.com. You're still listening to Arsenal for Democracy. I'm your host, Bill Humphrey. Still in studio with me is Nate. We're going to talk now about the FIFA situation, the various news that's been coming out about FIFA in the last week, following up on a lot of segments that we've been doing over the past couple of years on this show. So none of this is like a particularly huge surprise. Nate, what has been happening in the past couple of weeks with FIFA here?
Well, there was a raid in Zurich, I guess, where I guess we arrested a lot of the top officials of FIFA. So that's including many people in the leadership of CONCACAF and CONMEBOL, which are, I guess, the national or continental associations for North and South America, basically charging that top international officials of FIFA have been engaged in vote buying, wire fraud, racketeering, all money laundering, all these like major financial crimes, you know, all white collar and stuff that are usually associated with like mobsters, I guess, or, you know, shady corporations, things like that. That's basically what FIFA is. I mean, they're a monopoly of football all across the world. They are opulently corrupt, I guess you could say. Like, they, you know, meet in Zurich, obviously, in these palatial hotels. You know, they have guys, the guy who basically busted the whole thing for the U.S., Chuck Blazer, who used to be a U.S. soccer official, guy looks like Santa Claus, dresses up as Obi-Wan, used to rent a apartment in Trump Tower just for his cats. You know, this guy likes to live at large, and it turns out that it got to him, it caught up with him eventually, and he was wearing a wire at points. You know, he's basically turned on them and has been supplying the Justice Department with information for the past couple years. But basically, the allegations are, so, you know, you got Nike paying perhaps, you know, over $100 million in bribes. You have just pretty much for every tournament has been bought. Even the losing bids are bought. So, okay, England's complaining, oh, we were robbed of the tournament. Well, England paid the same bribes that South Africa did, or I guess Russia, because they were competing against Russia for the 2018 tournament. Maybe they didn't pay enough bribes, but, I mean, still paid bribes. So it's not like we can go on some moral high ground here where, like, oh, the, you know, oh, the Russians and the Qataris, you know, they stole it with their bribery, and the poor, innocent England and France and USA, we've done nothing wrong. No, it's not like that. Everyone's bribing everyone, and that's not even really the main issue.
Yeah, apparently the South Africans were horrified to learn that their bid had not been legitimately won. It was okay.
I believe it was, there was like a New Zealand guy who just abstained from the vote. So it would go, I believe, in 2006 to Germany, and South Africa was the other bid. And then they made sure to give it to South Africa the next year. And, like, it's a whole very complicated process involving, you know, like, envelopes of, like, $40,000 in cash, you know? And these are just being passed around, like, I don't know, just, like, a briefing folder or something. But, so, you know, you have this opulent corruption, but that's not even the main issue here. Because, you know, it's money. There are all these really ludicrously rich groups anyway. You know, it's not necessarily creating the best tournament situations and tournament bidding processes. But, I mean, that exists for the Olympics and things like that, too. So, honestly, that's not the thing I'm most concerned about with FIFA right now. the main thing is still the Qatar World Cup, right? So, okay, Russia has a lot of issues. We all know about those. Obviously, we saw the Olympics in Russia, how, like, the dorms for the athletes were not even finished. Like, okay, that's one thing. Then you have all Russia's human rights abuses, how it's basically, you know, a neo-Tsarist dictatorship. Okay, that's a problem. But at least if they're sort of a soccer nation, they have massive stadiums everywhere. They could host this World Cup without building a bunch of new stadiums. Whereas Qatar, on the other hand, you know, they're actually having to build a ton of new stadiums.
And cities.
Yeah, and basically cities, you know, because you need a city in the desert somewhere, but there's no cities there currently, so they have to build them before 2022, which actually isn't that long in the future, now that I'm thinking, it's only 7 years. Like, you gotta build a city, you gotta, you know, supply with everything, build some stadiums. And then that's not even getting into the fact that we're talking about potentially over 5,000 people dying as a result of slave labor conditions in the UAE, just because it's so hot there. Like, you can walk down the street and people have told stories of being picked up by cabbies because if you keep walking, you're just going to collapse of exhaustion, possibly die because it's that hot, you know. And we're being asked to have people playing in this hot conditions. People were having severe problems playing in the heat in some places in Brazil, but this is like even worse in some cases because there's a dry heat and very little humidity, and you're sort of being asked to play in these horrific conditions, possibly up to 40 degrees Celsius in some cases. Yeah. Like, this was during the summer, right?
And they had to move it.
Yeah, had to move it during the winter because the initial plan was for outdoor air-conditioned stadiums. I mean, that's not going to work.
Well, it's just not a thing that exists.
So, and then you have all these Nepali workers who basically they can't leave without getting permission from their employers because their passports are stuck with their employers. So they're basically being forced in these slave labor conditions. And many of them are just dying because this is extremely brutal, dangerous construction work in hot conditions in the desert. And, you know, this is far more morally significant, I would say, than any sort of corruption. Okay, money gets tossed around everywhere. In the end, I don't really care if Nike pays bribes to FIFA or whatever. It's the same thing as filling out a contract almost in the end. You're still paying money from one group to the other. Obviously, the awarding process is not in any way fair or non-corrupt. But the real issue is that you have these migrant workers dying in many ways because they can't leave, because they don't have any better options. In many ways, they sometimes will have to go over to find work outside of their home country just because, you know, they need to find a way to support their families. So, and then you occasionally get tricked into places where you thought you could leave, but turns out you really can't. So I'd say that's probably the most dangerous and significant thing. And a lot of these other, you know, corruption, we've known for years that FIFA is corrupt. And it is very important that we begin to try to, you know, move, reform FIFA, move away from that. But if we're still having the World Cup in Qatar, you know, Sepp Blatter won his re-election. Sepp Blatter, of course, the president of FIFA, was being opposed by, I believe, the Prince of Jordan, Prince Ali, didn't get enough support to unseat Blatter. So Blatter's still the president. But honestly, Blatter's not even necessarily the problem. There are other people that were in support of the Qatar World Cup more than him. And then you even have...
He's a problem, not the problem.
Well, like, the president of UEFA, this European group, Platini, I believe he was very much in support of the Qatar World Cup, more so than Blatter.
And he, I think, ended up backing Prince Ali, right?
Yeah.
The UEFA endorsed him.
And then you know, you have Beckenbauer going, a former German superstar defender, saying that, and this is like in the 60s, but he's an older member of... I'm not sure if he's officially part of FIFA, but he's obviously has influence. And he's saying, oh, I don't see any slaves over there. Like, basically denying that the whole thing is even happening. And that's honestly monstrous. So, okay, you have those things that are extremely, extremely dangerous, I would say. This is now where we get into, it's more speculative, I would say, because we don't quite have the same hard evidence that you'd have about wire fraud or anything like that. But the possibility that certain World Cup matches... they weren't quite on the level. And what I mean by that is there's been a history in terms of allegations, maybe not necessarily anything that's significantly proven, but basically about allegations of match fixing, referee bias in the World Cup. And the prime example of that is in 2002. The games were, of course, hosted in South Korea. And I believe some were in Japan as well, yeah. So it was joint hosting. But the South Koreans made it to the semifinal. And let's just say there were a couple interesting decisions on that road. So they played Portugal, had a couple men, that Portugal had a couple men sent off. They played Italy. Italy had a golden goal ruled offsides. That would have like won them the game, right? Because it's an extra time. Over the course of the game, you have just a lot of very violent play. Like, it's on both sides, but like, I recently watched a video. I'm trying to rewatch the whole games, but it seemed like in some cases the South Koreans weren't even tackling. They were just sort of like jumping on the Italians' backs. And of course, the Italians are throwing elbows, as is, you know, their want. But the thing is, there were just a lot of just shaky decisions, goals incorrectly ruled offside. And then the next match against Spain, there were multiple goals ruled offside in that one. Red cards given to the Spanish, but I guess there was one where it was a perfectly good goal and they tried to claim that the ball had gone out of bounds, even though, okay, so you know, in soccer, the ball has to go all the way out of bounds for it to count. Ball barely went out of bounds at all, like any part of the ball going out of bounds. So that was one that was clearly just like, oh, can't let them score. Can't let Spain score. Got to take it away. So these are the kind of things that, and this was recognized by pretty much everyone at the time, like, something is not right here. What's going on? And it wasn't even like the Koreans were bad and had to be dragged necessarily. Like, they played pretty good soccer, but they were just the beneficiaries of way too many reffing decisions for it to be viewed as a non-shady game, right? So, I mean, that's a pretty famous example. But there have been a lot of other games, too, where people have been suspicious, even going back to 1966, when, of course, England won the World Cup. There are people have alleged that they had the German referees ref the England semifinal games and vice versa. So they were able to engineer, they would meet up in the finals. Even like this past World Cup in 2014, you had some people alleging, and I know this is a little controversial, but the 7-1 result, some people think that some of the Brazil players might have been bought to the point where they're just not going 100% during that game. And I mean, if you go back and rewatch the tapes, there are certain things that just don't make sense. So just if you look at the positions and decision making of some of the Brazilian defenders. So I'm not saying that was a fixed match, but there are just these little things. And once you start breaking through the facade of, oh, FIFA would never fix the match, or, oh, they would never award a tournament to, you know, this desert slave empire. So, you know, what wouldn't they do? And this isn't just FIFA. There are allegations of match fixing and all sorts of different types of corruptions in UEFA as well. You know, various leagues all around the world, pretty much. Apparently, leagues in Asia are you know, notorious for corruption. And there was actually an interesting interview I read about the 06 World Cup. This guy's a Guardian article. He went and met with like this guy who was getting phone calls pretty much like every couple minutes about which matches to fix. It's like a Southeast Asian gambling cartel or something. And the guy was like, got into the inside and he started spilling all these secrets about like which games in the 06 World Cup were fixed and stuff. It was really fascinating. I went back and checked some of the games and I don't know, some of it actually lined up pretty well, including England, Trinidad and Tobago possibly in the group stage in 06. So I just wouldn't rule out any of these possibilities. Like, we don't know which matches are fixed. But if you watch enough soccer and then all of a sudden people start behaving in ways that don't like make sense if they're trying to win the game, like that's when you start getting a little suspicious. So the real, I guess you could say the real issue here is not entirely that, okay, people are paying bribes, but the real issue is that soccer internationally is being run by an organization that appears to just be so blatantly corrupt that they almost, in some ways, I sort of envision them as like these aristocrats in like 17th, 16th century Europe, where it's all make believe. It's all fun and games. You know, they're living in these palaces and just sort of dancing around and not really seeming to care how the actual, you know, things going on the ground. So, I mean, that's just sort of how I look at it. The bribes, not the end of the world, obviously need to be cleaned up, but the real issue is slave labor.
And the consequences
of the bribes. Games that we don't know if they're necessarily real or not. So
I want to talk, though, a little bit more about the raid before we wrap up this segment. This is, I guess, happened mainly because Loretta Lynch had finally been confirmed as the U.S. Attorney General. And previously, as I understand it, she had actually been running most of this investigation from a lower level in the Justice Department when she was in New York. So the timing, I guess, makes sense. Why did it take the U.S. to do this, and what exactly was the U.S. connection here, if any? As it seemed like it was a little bit tenuous, that it was mostly like we had to do it from the U.S. because no one else was going to be able to, but then there wasn't like a clear violation happening in the U.S. Yeah,
that's part of it. But the U.S. also received a lot of praise from other places in the world for going after this, because in a lot of places, their footballing associations, or FAs, I guess you could say, are usually relatively powerful in like their country's political establishment, I guess, considering that just the relative popularity of the sport, probably have percentage wise more money and more things tied up in it, might even perhaps be involved in the official capacity of paying some of these bribes. So I don't know, maybe they're not necessarily the ones that are, okay, we need to launch an investigation, because they might already know what, you know, what that might find. But obviously, I think the reason the U.S. is launching it, and Lynch, I thought, has done a pretty good job in her opening press conference, and hopefully will continue to do well, just the fact that this is all going on in America because of just the way FIFA operates. So you have all these nations that are all involved, like they all get pretty much the same amount from FIFA. So like a tiny island in the Caribbean will get the same amount as America. But because of the relative strength, or the relative importance, at least recently in FIFA, of North and South America, you have a lot of these bribes going down on U.S. soil or through organizations that are based in the U.S., you know. So anytime you have various fraudulent transfers, I guess you could say that they're potentially, you know,
jurisdiction.
Yeah, under the U.S. jurisdiction. There are a lot of like blatant stealing money cases where they're like, okay, we're going to give you this many million to build like this football facility, and it's like a dirt pitch and like a couple goals, and it's like, where'd the rest of the money go? That's interesting.
Right. Okay. So it seems like the story here is that not only was there actually standing to do these prosecutions, but also the opportunity in that there was so much less influence of, you know, MLS or something like that to like be, you know, overriding FIFA or protecting FIFA, whichever. So,
and I think this has been building for a little while. Obviously, we've talked about how they've been gathering information through guys wearing wires, as, you know, compare this to the mafia. Okay, like that's what you need to do to gather the information. And you just need to build up enough of a case, I guess, because, as I said, people have known for years that FIFA is grotesquely corrupt. But it's a difference between sort of thinking and suspecting it and actually like getting the hard details about like, okay, Nike is bribing FIFA with like over $100 million in order to, you know, get the certain rights or whatever. So when you have this level of corruption, and it's almost like so blatant in some cases, that's why the U.S. is now looking into it and taking direct action.
All right, Nate, that's going to bring us to the close of this segment. Thank you so much for being here and providing these insights.
Thanks, Bill.
All right, Arsenal for Democracy will be right back in just a moment. You're listening to Arsenal for Democracy. I'm your host, Bill Humphrey. Joining me on the line is Kevin, a fellow Blue Hen, graduate of the University of Delaware. We're going to talk now a little bit about Bo Biden. Wish it could be under better circumstances, but welcome to the program, Kevin.
Thanks, Bill. Certainly wish that we could be talking about a happier subject today.
So, you know, I when I was in Delaware and was at UD, I was the president of the College Democrats for a while. And at the same time, you were involved in volunteering on one of Bo's campaigns. So I don't think either of us necessarily knew him all that well, but it certainly seems like he had a very strong presence, not just because of his name, but because of his personality. He had a strong presence throughout the state and the political scene. So, you know, it was important to both of us to talk about him a little bit. I was wondering, what were a few things that you remembered from, you know, the times that you met him, or things that you heard about him from other people that really stuck with you?
One of the big things was definitely his energy. I think I first met him 4th of July 2010, I'm going to say, at the Hocus Inn parade, and I think that was a few weeks after what was announced to be his mild stroke. And I just remember how much energy he had, and thinking, you know, he had more energy than I did, and he'd been in the hospital, you know, 6-7 weeks earlier. And I remember that day, you know, I think I was a couple cars ahead, like with the Beau car, and he was, you know, 4 or 5 cars back, and the announcer joked, you know, just like his dad, you know, Beau Biden was shaking everybody's hand on the parade route and was, you know, almost probably, you know, 400 yards behind where he was supposed to be, just because that was his nature, you know, to talk to everybody.
Yeah, I think I met him a little bit later, I think October 2010, and I think that might have been the only time that I had any, you know, significant conversation with him. The thing that really jumped out at me was that, you know, he really didn't seem like he was, you know, he had that energy because he cared, right? But he didn't seem like he was in it to be in politics. That was never seemed the goal. And you'll hear various politicians say that, but you don't necessarily believe it when everyone says it. But you could believe, you know, that whether it was serving as attorney general or, you know, helping his dad around the country in various campaign things or, you know, serving in Iraq, it seemed like he was very sincere when he would say, you know, make it sound like he basically would rather be anywhere else, you know, be with his family, that kind of thing. But he felt like he had a duty, an obligation to the people of Delaware, to the, you know, people in the rest of the country, to the people in Iraq, wherever he was serving, that he had an obligation to do this job, especially because of his last name, that this was sort of the family business and it was his job to kind of serve there. I think that if he had had another choice and not been a Biden, you know, I'm sure he would have still felt called to serve, but maybe he wouldn't have felt like he had to be, you know, really, you know, going to the mat on all these, you know, political campaigns and things like that. But it seems like he certainly made it, made the time that he had on this earth productive. You know, I think he was also pretty concerned because of his, because of Joe Biden's health issues around, you know, his 40s, back in the day, that this was a concern, a possibility that he might not have that long. But yeah, did you have any sort of similar experiences about, you know, him discussing sort of views on public service or anything like that?
Yeah, I mean, I remember this going back 5 years. He had talked about, you know, how he ended up, you know, in the Delaware National Guard, ultimately led him into serving in Iraq. And I wish I remembered, you know, better how the wording that he used at the time. But, you know, but certainly I remember he joined the National Guard, I'd say later in the career. You know, he didn't join, you know, fresh out of high school, because I think, you know, because of his skills as a lawyer, you know, he felt almost an obligation to join the National Guard, because I recall he had joined the JAG Corps, and that's what his duties were when he was in Iraq. So mainly it wasn't necessarily, you know, that he had joined, you know, as an 18-year-old kid out of high school, but it was basically joining to use the skills that he had developed in his professional career to help others.
Right. And he was doing that sort of legal work with the National Guard, you know, even at the same time that he was the Attorney General of Delaware. So, you know, trying to do two jobs. And then I don't even think he would have maybe run for re-election at all in 2010 if he hadn't been in the middle of that prosecution. I think it was a child abuse prosecution or something like that. And he felt really compelled to, like, stick it out, you know, rather than saying, I've just gotten back from Iraq, I'd like to spend time with my family, you know, and maybe stay out of the spotlight. It seemed like he felt like he really had to sort of see through that job that he had started in his first term.
Yeah, I believe that was the Bradley case. I don't remember when that conviction took place, but I know it was certainly around the time of the end of his first campaign, beginning of his second campaign.
Well, did you have any other, you know, last recollection or memory that you wanted to bring up about Beau Biden before we close out the show?
No, you know, obviously my thoughts and prayers are with Hallie and his parents, and, you know, he leaves behind 2 young kids, which is, you know, a terrible tragedy in itself. And obviously, you know, I think the whole country and the state of Delaware thinking about that family that's had so much loss and pain over the years.
Very well said. All right. Thank you so much, Kevin, for joining us to talk about this today.
All right. Thanks, Bill.
And that's all the time we have this week. Thanks for listening to Arsenal for Democracy. Tweet us your comments at AFDRadio or email AFDRadio@gmail.com. The show is available for download from ArsenalForDemocracy.com on Wednesdays. You can also hear it on the air in Delaware from 91.3 FM WVUD and WVUD HD1 Newark every Wednesday night at 6 p.m. Eastern. Special thanks to my voiceover man, Justin. You can follow his work at the Digitized Ramblings of an 8-Bit Animal from 8BitAnimal.com. You can get additional commentary at ArsenalForDemocracy.com daily, as well as links to articles discussed today. From my studio in Newton, Massachusetts, I'm Bill Humphrey, and I approve this message. Good night.